So, yesterday evening got some good news. I was a bit worried about this, but it turned out to be very good news that census figures came out for 2011. And I knew that if Buddhism hadn't increased in Australia, I'd be in big trouble. I would lose my productivity bonus. Because after all, it's all about sales figures with our Buddhist society. And very happy to say that in 2006, when the previous census was about 2.1% of people in Australia said they were Buddhist. Now we're up to, have a guess, 2.5. So we've grown again. And one of the monks, as Ajahn Sujata, he actually looked at the figures over the last four or five censuses and seen just the Buddhist line go up, up, up. And he saw the Christian line go down, down, down. And he worked out, you know, just extrapolating the lines, that in 2057, Buddhism will take over as a major It doesn't really work that way, but it's a very funny thing to say. But I'm sure that's only just come out in the last couple of days. So I'm sure that many people will soon be asking you, as they did last time, that Buddhism was growing. Why? And anyway, just a very interesting piece of information did come up a few years ago that somebody over in the United States, a couple of people, sociologists, they did this lovely bit of research where they actually asked people who went to Buddhist temples, you know, who read Buddhist books, who meditated, listened to Buddhist things on the internet, who had lots of Buddhist books and stuff at their home, you know, whether they called themselves Buddhist or not. And roughly about 50% said, no, we don't call ourselves anything. You know, we don't give ourselves a name. Even though by all usual measures, you know, we call people a Buddhist. They come to Buddhist temples, they do Buddhist things. But it's one of those wonderful things, you know, in our modern world. Just because you're inclined to one particular path, you don't confine yourself and put yourself in a prison saying, I'm a Buddhist, thinking that you can't be anything else. Because that particular part of naming, we know that, I teach that to many people. If any of you think that, you know, you are sort of got attention deficit disorder, or you are a criminal, or you are depressed, as soon as you put yourself in a box like that and give yourself a label, it does cause a huge amount of problems for you. The sort of problems it causes, you know, was very well illustrated by that famous story when I went to give a speech at a conference on mental health in Singapore, when one of the listeners, he was the head of the schizophrenic unit in the biggest, actually the only mental health campus on Singapore Island. And when he said he was impressed with my talk and I asked him, what do you do? He said, I'm the head of the schizophrenic unit. And I asked him how he treats schizophrenia. And he replied straight away, I do not treat schizophrenia. And then I started, you know, he did a double take. He was the head of the department, the head of this whole unit. And he told me he doesn't treat schizophrenia. So what do you do then? And he said, just as you explained in your talk, Ajahn Brahm, I treat the other part of the patient. And I just was so impressed with this guy. I actually lifted up my hands and sort of did an act of respect and worship. Exactly, because if you call yourself a schizophrenic, if that's your label, if that's who you think you are, there's very little chance of getting out of that disease. But by treating the other part of the patient, then they're acknowledging there is much more to them than just this one little part. And it's true that people have schizophrenic episodes. Does that make you a schizophrenic? You may have angry episodes, but that make you angry. Just like that person in a talk I gave in Malaysia. At the end of the talk, they asked a question. And sometimes you get really serious questions at the end of the talk. And the question was, should I get divorced? Why? Because that morning she had found out her husband had lied to her. And she said, I can't trust him any longer. How could you live in a relationship when your husband lies to you? And he said, I can't live in a relationship anymore. Should I leave? So, to answer the question, it was in a university. I asked her these two questions. Now, how long have you been married and what are you doing this university? She said she'd been married for 3 years and she was teaching mathematics. And that gave me the opportunity to give a really nice answer. So you'll teach mathematics, so let's do some simple statistics. 3 years, that's 1,000 days, give or take. So let's assume, for this little argument, over 3 years of marriage, every day, your husband has said 20 facts to you, which could be right or could be wrong. That's a fair assumption. On average, 20 statements, which could be right, which could be wrong. So in 3 years of marriage, 1,000 days, that's 20,000 things your husband has said to you, and now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, that means the next time he opens his mouth, there's a 20,000-to-1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean he can't be trusted? That's a very good argument. But it was not just an argument to keep them together. It was an argument to prove that when a person lies once, we think they're a liar and they can't be trusted. When a person steals, we call them a thief. If a person comes to a Buddhist temple, we call them a Buddhist. You see what I'm coming for? So sometimes these labels, they put us in a box. And that's one of the reasons. In this research, they found out that of all the people who came to temples, who should really call themselves Buddhists if they did the same thing for any other religion, but half of them said, no, we're just people. And half of them said they were Buddhist. So, on that sort of piece of evidence, and our society is pretty much the same here in Australia. There's probably about 5% of Australians who probably would qualify as being Buddhists. Now, many of you come here, and you probably even don't call yourself Buddhist, but you've been coming here for years and years and years. So it actually is a Buddhist. It's a wonderful thing we can give you that freedom. You don't have to say you're a Buddhist. You can if you want. You don't have to if you don't want to, but you can still come here. Because part of Buddhism, it grew up in a democracy in India, and that democratic ideal of giving you the freedom of choice and control over your own spiritual life is one of the essential parts of the Buddhist teachings. And it's also an essential part of your life and your life with other people. Stop controlling people. The whole idea of giving people authority, giving people their own spiritual authority, is essential to Buddhism. You may not know this, but one of the key events in the life of the Buddha was when he was about to pass away, somebody asked him, you're obviously the boss, you're the leader, who is going to take over when you pass away? And very clearly, precisely, the Buddha said something which separated Buddhism from so many other religions and also was one of the reasons I say it's popular in our modern world. He said, no one will be a leader. Let the teachings be your leader from here on. And that was a very powerful little message. So no one is your leader. We don't have a pope. We don't have an archbishop. We don't have an ayatollah. Even though the names of the nuns are ayahs, that's what we usually call them. But actually it was one nun who was very, very dominant and they sort of gave her the nickname ayatollah. But that was a bit mean. The ayatollah, because she was the head of a nunnery, they called her the abbess, not the abbess. So that was really, I won't say who that was. That's a long time ago. But anyhow, we don't have those leaders, which is a wonderful little thing when we give spiritual authority to each one of you rather than telling you exactly what you should be doing. And that's one of the wonderful things of our modern world, because people want their independence. They want guidance, just like in schools. Maybe in old days you had rote learning, you were told what to believe, and you're in big trouble if you said anything different. But in these days, we don't do that. We're taught how to think, we're given information, trying to find out how to understand this information for ourselves. We're given a lot of freedom. And that's been part of the Buddhism from the very, very beginning. Because it gives you that freedom as well to not control your own body and mind, to let it be, to be kind. It's a strange thing. But when we stop controlling everything, you know, as a monk, I don't control you. Yeah, I'm officially the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And as Dennis, he was a president for, I don't know how many years you've been a president. I know that sometimes they gave me the nickname the spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society, but I wasn't a dictator, not even in a monastery very often. You know, you see that I'm wearing a jacket over my shoulder, the monk sitting next to me isn't. Because, you know, he does what he likes, I do what I like. In the sense that we have this great sense of letting people make up their own decisions on what they want to do in this world. That giving people authority over their spiritual life is also learning how to give yourself that little bit of authority and freedom over your body and mind. Not always trying to control it and make it be this way and that way. Because you find if you try and control your body and mind, even controlling your body, I like mentioning that anecdote about Jerusalem. I've got the paper in my room, I forget what year it was. The doctors went on strike for 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks, what happened? The death rate in the hospitals plummeted. People were much healthier when the doctors weren't on the job. Interesting. Think about it. I know there's a few doctors in here. They'll probably argue with me. But it's interesting. When the traffic lights don't work, you know, the traffic goes actually quite smoothly. Most people have a give and take. When you don't control your partner, she's much better and more kind and more helpful to you than if you put her in a box and tell her what to do and what not to do. How many of you have been in a relationship like that when someone's tried to control you? How many of you have been in an office where someone's tried to control you? How many of you try and control yourselves and get yourself all stressed up? Now, is that really the way to peace and happiness in this life? It's a strange little thing, but somehow or other, this Buddha, many, many centuries ago, managed to see something which for most people is counterintuitive. We always think that if we don't control, things will go wrong. If we don't sort of try and control our partner, our partner will misbehave. If we don't control our kids will misbehave. I don't know about you, maybe I was really weird, but my parents were so non-controlling. Positive, encouraging, but basically, you know, if you wanted to do it, you're not going to hurt, go and do it. If it does hurt, that's the way you're going to learn. And that degree of freedom, I still remember the sort of stuff I got up to. I was amazed that, you know, even though I was only 17, my mother gave me full permission to take my guitar and go hitchhiking from London all the way to North Africa. It must have sort of driven her crazy with fear. But, you know, I did it. I survived and learnt so much about myself and about taking responsibility. Little things like that really show you. If you try and control, have you been controlled by your parents? And what's it like? Eventually you rebel anyway. So my parents realised he's going to rebel anyway, so I might as well give him permission to rebel. And then, you know, then rebelling wasn't all that much fun anymore. But you can see just like letting people be, letting yourself be. It's like fundamental to one of the reasons why, you know, the Buddha said, no, just let the teachings be your teacher. Now, learning how to be wise and compassionate enough to yourself and others, you don't need to control. It just becomes wisdom power rather than willpower. And wisdom power is just learning how to be kind to yourself and being kind to your partner, being kind to the people who work in the office, and that way people want to work for you. You get much more out of people, out of yourself, out of life, through encouragement and inspiration than through force. Which is why the Buddha said, no, they're the teachings. Because once it's authorities and, you know, people tell you what to do, that's where everything starts to go wrong. I told this story because, you know, sometimes these hierarchies, which you see too often in this world, the hierarchies in politics is one of the great causes of corruption in politics. I told the story of this one guy who, or these three people who were standing for pre-selection, you know, at some sort of election for parliament. And the last three were selected, and these, you know, board of grandees in the party had to interview them to see which one they wanted to be their candidate for the election. So it all came down just to one question to each candidate, and the question was a very simple one. The first candidate came in and said, okay, straight away, what is 2 + 2? And the candidate got out their calculator and said, 4. Very good. Don't call us. We'll call you. Second candidate came in, what's 2 + 2? Have to have the same question to standardize everything. And he said, 4. Very good. Come back later on. And they asked the third candidate, what's 2 + 2? And he said, whatever you tell me is, boss. And he got the job. Now, that's what happens with hierarchies. You have to please people so much that sometimes it corrupts people, because that's what happens when there is that type of control. You do what pleases people rather than what's right. Have you been in an office like that? Have you been in a relationship like that? Do you regard yourself like that? I'm not going to do what's right, I'm going to do what's pleasing. So it's too often, sometimes that controlling, that is one of the biggest causes for problem. What the Buddha actually said, this is called he called it the Four Noble Truths. Craving leads to suffering, letting go leads to peace. Simple thing. The Buddha saw that in all avenues of life. Give people trust. And most of the time they will live up to that trust. Give you trust. Yourself trust. And most times you will actually rise up to that trust. That's why the Buddha said, no more hierarchy. We're not going to tell you what to do. We're going to give you inspiration, give you encouragement. Now it's up to you. You go and walk that path. Because it understands that there's most people, they want to have this freedom, they want to have this peace, they want respect. That's one of the amazing things in life. We just want to be respected for who we are. We may not be the best, we may not be perfect, but we want to be respected for who we are. Yes, that husband told a lie once, but he still wants respect. One lie doesn't mean you don't respect a person. We all make mistakes from time to time, and it's okay to make mistakes from time to time. One of the greatest things which I learned from Buddhism, you're still respected, even if you make a big mistake and a big blue. So understanding that gives you this great sense of freedom. And again, it's counterintuitive, but it works if you let yourself make mistakes, you don't make so many. A lot of times we're so afraid, because this is what happens when we're controlled. Control and fear always go together. And you know, many sort of religions do that. And if you don't follow my teachings, yeah, you'll go to hell. And then we describe what the hell is. I know people have got a perverse sense of, you know, what is entertainment. So, you know, they like actually seeing people beaten up. And I saw a picture about this extreme boxing or wrestling. They put people in a cage and they can allow to beat each other up however much they want. Why do people watch that? You crazy sadists. But, you know, there's a certain amount of certain amount of pleasure and stuff like that, isn't it? And so sometimes that, you know, we like to be afraid. It takes a lot of courage and spiritual growth to allow people, yourself, to make mistakes. And don't be afraid of such things. And, you know, don't allow sort of, you know, people who start talking about hells and what might happen to you, you know, if you die and what if you don't follow these teachings and go to my church and don't go to other people's church. That's why there are many people, actually, they come here. They come to the Buddhist Society on a Friday. They go to church on a Saturday. They go to the mosque on a Sunday, you know, just to cover all bases, just in case. But now, does that really make sense? You know, living a life through fear and through control. To me, it doesn't make sense at all. But one of the great things about, you know, the teachings, one of the reasons why it does actually really take off in a country like Australia, in the Western world, is because, you know, people have got a taste for independence and making their own decisions. And part of making your own decisions is also learning to allow yourself to make mistakes. Because it's in those mistakes, that's where we actually learn, that's where we actually grow. This simile comes up. I told a simile a few weeks ago, but it's a beautiful simile about life and about mistakes. It was a simile when I had to set my first exam paper as a teacher. I was a school teacher for 1 year. I often say that anyone who teaches in a high school, after 1 year, I think anyone would think about being a monk or a nun. I actually did it. In a teenager, it's really hard. But anyway, so I, you know, was teaching, and I had to set the first examination, and it's not easy to set an examination. I mean, what are you supposed to do? So I went to one of the senior teachers, and he said, look, try and set the level of difficulty so the average score becomes 70%. Because he said, if everybody gets, you know, top marks, or we get 100% or 95, 90%, it's a waste of time. It's not a real test. It's too easy. But if everybody gets 30, 40, 50%, that means that they get discouraged. They lose motivation and they give up. They think, I can't do that subject. So he told me, please set the level to be about 70%, because that will encourage people. They get about 70% right. That's the average. They'll be encouraged. Yeah, they can do that subject. And the 30% where they make mistakes, he says, that's where you, their teacher, can see their weak points. So in the next lessons, you can address those areas where they haven't understood what you've been teaching. The mistakes. And I took that to be a wonderful metaphor for life. If any of you get 100% in life, you're learning nothing. It's not a test. You don't grow. If you get 40, 50% in life or less, that's where you get depressed and feel yourself hopeless and lose all your self-esteem. But if you get about 70% in life, that is the best. You're encouraged. Yeah, you're having happiness, you're having some success, you feel good about yourself, you can do some things, but you're making 30% mistakes. Brilliant. Because that's where you learn. So if you've got a partner, they're 100%, they're a waste of time, dump them. If they're 50%, oh, that's hopeless. That's too difficult. If you've got a partner, they're 70% nice and loving, and 30% they nag you and they criticize you. That is the very, very best. That is the right level. Because that's where you can learn together and grow together. So the 70% rule about life. If you're having a life and you're always making a lot of happiness, things are going right, you don't learn things. That's why mistakes like that, you can actually encourage them and just accept them and say, this is my learning, this is where we grow. But more than that, when we accept them, mistakes happen and they're part of life, and it's just the right amount of mistakes, 30% to 70% successes. It also means that we're not afraid of mistakes. We're not afraid of mistakes. All this idea about controlling ourselves and controlling others disappears. And so the authority of you over other people, you're not allowed to make mistakes, you tell your partner. You're not allowed to tell me a lie once every 3 years. That's pretty good, isn't it? So please allow your partner, give him permission. Write it on a piece of paper before you're married. I hereby give you permission to lie, you know, every once every 3 years. Or maybe increase it, maybe negotiate. But at least you're not asking each other to be perfect, which means you're not controlling, which means the other person feels free. Yes, they can make mistakes, so we can learn from it, we can grow from it. But the point is, when we're not afraid to make mistakes, we don't tend to make any. At least we don't tend to make so many. So this is where we understand that not controlling, letting go, not having authority or exercising authority, things go much smoother, much better, more successful in life. And for a lot of people, when they have any psychological problems or other problems in life, so often people come up to me and they say, oh, they're feeling really depressed. I say, wonderful, you're feeling depressed. And straight away they say, what? What do you mean? You know, aren't you going to try and cure me? And I say, no, because Buddhism is not into converting people. I'm not going to convert you from being someone depressed into somebody who is happy. Because that idea of converting and changing you is just trying to control you again. I'm going to say to you, just be happy being depressed. Try and look at all the benefits of being depressed. For example, you don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. That's pretty good. You don't have to, do things. People love to do things for you because, you don't have to be happy. You don't have to smile at people because I'm depressed. I can be miserable. It's very hard being a monk. I'm not allowed to be miserable. I'm always supposed to be happy. So I demand my right as a teacher to be miserable from time to time. And when I give myself that freedom to be miserable, when you give yourself your freedom to be depressed, you don't get depressed anymore. This is only a theory. We know a lot of depression, where it comes from and why there's an increase in depression in our modern world. This is a theory, but I know my mind so well, and I've taught so many other people. My mind and your mind are just exactly the same brand. And the way it works is because we have so many expectations and aspirations, we control so much, we force ourselves. Like at work and in life, you have to force yourself to be successful in today's world. And you control so much that you come to a point where you get frustrated, where you just can't push through things. People in your office keep frustrating you. Your partner just is not compliant. And even yourself, you can't sort of force yourself to do what you want to do. Sooner or later, control freaks always come across frustration. And when you get frustrated, most people, they just put forth more energy. They force even harder. Come on, when the going gets tough, the tough even get tougher. And what happens after a while is you come across these brick walls in life, things which you cannot change, which you can't control, which you can't do anything about. And people just give up. They give up and they just force themselves so much. They're just exhausted. That's one of the great reasons, causes of depression. Control, frustration, anger, all energy gone, and to depression. All coming because too many control freaks. If you don't be a control freak, you never ever get depressed. So that's why when we take away authority things over yourself and over your life, you tend to flow with things. You don't control things anymore. Yeah, if the aircraft leaves on time, fine. If it doesn't leave on time, there's always another aircraft tomorrow. It doesn't really matter because I travel a lot. Sometimes my aircraft are delayed. It happens all the time. The last aircraft which I flew to come back here yesterday was Thai Airways coming back from Bangkok. People told me that's what the word TG means. That's the airline code. TG means tomorrow, go. That's why they always have Asia. Have Thai time, Sri Lankan time, Indonesian time. Indonesian time, whenever it happens, it happens. Things never go according to schedule. Isn't that beautiful when they don't go according to schedule? They just happen. And all the time, things in Buddhist temples or any Asian religion temples, they're also all chaotic. It happens, but no one's ordered. You don't have little places to sit in, not rows or chairs. You're sitting all over the place. Even my robe is not controlled. It keeps falling off. But that just is a symbol that we're not control freaks in this religion. And because of that, I often tell people this is one of the other reasons why Buddhism is very popular in Australia, why it grows, is because people hate organized religion. Buddhism is disorganized religion. It happens, but, I don't know how it happens. We try to organize all this stuff, but, it's all chaotic. But eventually, you get your receipts. Eventually, you get your acknowledgement that you got your tickets to go to this event yesterday. It's disorganized religion. Just like your life is disorganized. That's why it's fun. Imagine if you're such a control freak, you organize your program for today and you organize exactly what you're going to do on this weekend. Have you got your plans for this weekend? Oh, come on. Get a life, for goodness sake. Throw away those plans and just be and see what happens. And that's what I do. I give these talks. I actually decided to give a talk on something else this evening, but it's thrown out the window. I'm giving a talk about something else. And now that's really fun when you don't have any plans and just, you know, see what happens next. Line number one, life gets exciting. You're innovative. Actually, you're alive. People who have plans are just running on automatic, as if you've been programmed for this weekend. This is what you got to do Saturday morning, and Saturday lunchtime you got to go here, and Saturday afternoon you got to go somewhere else, and Saturday night you got to do this. Is that the sort of life you want, where it's all programmed and worked out in advance? Come on, get a life. And that means you can innovate and you can experiment and you can actually get into some really interesting things in life. Well, I do have a very interesting life. You know, sometimes, actually the last week, last Friday, last Friday, I shouldn't really admit this, but last Friday I was hanging out in a 5-star hotel by the beach in Khao Lak, north of Phuket. What's a monk doing? I didn't ask to do this. I didn't pay for it. They're organising this retreat, this 9-day retreat, executive retreat. This is where they decide to book the hotel. That's where I went. Really nice, really great life as a monk. I get to do really, really interesting things. Other times you get invited to go and see autopsies. So you see bodies cut up in a morgue. You know, it's amazing what I get. Actually, one of these places I went to, you know, in Thailand, because Thailand's a Buddhist country, you can walk into the morgue because they won't stop a Buddhist monk. You just go in there and see what's going on in there. So I remember the first... It's true. One of the first places, I couldn't really believe this, but this is a true story, I'm not making it up. I went into this autopsy room in Sirirat Hospital in Bangkok. It's just opposite the river, the main hospital, well, one of the main hospitals in Bangkok. I went in there very early, they hadn't started the autopsy yet, and I was in the room by myself. They had these, you know, these high windows, and I looked at one of the windows, and it was really something strange. The place where you'd usually expect a pot plant, there was a head. And I thought this was some fake head, like, you know, some sort of model. But I went up there and poked it. It was actually a real head cut off. It was like some monster movie, but there it was. I don't know whose it was, but they just put it on a plate, and there it was on the window in the sunshine. It's really weird. But I get to do stuff like that. Weird life as a Buddhist monk. But the thing is that a lot of times it's totally out of control. You never know what you're going to do next, and that makes life very interesting. So please stop making plans, otherwise you're a control freak. I decided, this is a great insight I had. When I make plans, or sorry, let's look at it the other way around. When I don't make plans, things go wrong. You ever notice that? You make plans, you get frustrated, people don't turn up, something happens and you just can't do it the right way you expect it to. When I don't make plans, things go wrong. When I do make plans, things go wrong anyway. So, you know, I've noticed that. You make a plan, you don't make a plan, it's all the same. It all goes wrong. It never turns out which way you expected. So knowing it's going to go wrong anyway, I might as well not make any plans. It's much more fun that way. So you try that this weekend. Try that. Have one day a no-plans day. See if you can handle it. You get up in the morning, I've got no plans. See what happens. You know that we have this great relationship with the Benedictine monks up at New Norcia. We always meet each other once a year and have, you know, we talk secret monks business. Nothing secret about it. But I remember one of those monks, Father Bernard, he's a really good guy. He once, you know, we just chat about all sorts of stuff. And he said, you know, it's just a wonderful feeling, isn't it? When you wake up one morning and you've got nothing to do all day. And I said, wow, yeah, that's really true. Have you ever done that? You wake up in the morning, you've got no plans, nothing you have to do all day. That's bliss. No plans. You go shopping if you want, but you don't have to. You can have lunch whenever you want. You've got no people to meet, no place to go, no TV shows you have to watch. Isn't that great to wake up in the morning and have nothing to do all day? No plans. That's bliss. Why don't you have a go at that? One day a year, maybe your birthday or someday, have a no plans day. Now, what you're doing there, you're understanding why this authority, telling yourself what to do, causes so much stress, causes so much pain and suffering. it causes you to get so tense that that's where many of the problems come from. I have to do this. Okay, yeah, we have to do a few things in life. You know, you've got to sort of go to work and get the money and stuff like that and keep the law. But sometimes we just over-control our life. And one of the beautiful things about Buddhism is say, hey, maybe we'll try another way. Try another way that the plan of your life is just to be kind. Period. To have a day ruled not by schedules, but by compassion. To look at your partner you live with and say, the only rule which I have, I want you to keep, is I be kind to you and you be kind to me. You know, we have rules in monasteries, and this is true of Venerable Upasamo. That's the correct pronunciation of his name. But, you know, he would affirm this. We have our list of monastic rules. You know, what we should do, how we should do it, you know, how we should, you know, eat our food, the bowls we should use, where we should sit, blah, blah, blah. But when we were compiling those monastic rules, I insisted that rule number one, the top of all these other little rules, was you must be compassionate. That was the most important rule in Bodhinyana Monastery. That is the most important rule in this place too, more than anything else. Sometimes there are customs which people are supposed to keep. Customs like you're not supposed to point your feet at a Buddha statue. But I tell, look, if the Buddha was alive and you had to point your feet at him, what would the Buddha say? You say, oh, never mind, your poor feet. You can point them to me if you want. I don't mind. Or one thing which actually did happen here once, I was giving a talk, and this is an example of just, you know, what real Buddhism is, what wrong Buddhism is, like kindness, compassion, letting things be rather than being such control freaks. There was a person came, while I was giving the talk, they lay down, they fell asleep, which is fine, but then they started snoring loudly, right in the middle of my talk. And people next to them, they woke them up. And afterwards, I scolded those people, said, never do that again. If people want to go to sleep during my talk, you're most welcome to. Next time, bring your pillow and a blanket. Because I talked to that girl beforehand, and she told me she was going through some very traumatic domestic abuse. Big time. She was trying to get some counselling, but she just came here because here she felt safe. Here she felt welcomed. And she hadn't slept for days. As you can imagine, you know, domestic abuse. So afraid that she can't go to sleep. She came here in this warm atmosphere, kindness, peace. She lay down and had the first decent sleep, you know, for days. And some people woke her up. So please don't do that again. Because you don't know why a person has to go to sleep. If they want to go to sleep, that's fine by us. See the importance of kindness over too many rules? Why we don't have an authority figure in Buddhism? Why the Dhamma, kindness, compassion, that's your teacher? So when you have kindness, compassion as your main teacher, it's amazing just how all of these precepts, this goodness, all these things you're supposed to do, they're just expressions of kindness. Not killing animals, not swatting mosquitoes, not taking what's not yours, not stealing, not committing adultery, you know, breaking your relationships. That's just kindness to the person you live with. It hurts. It hurts really badly. They found out, you know, you've been having a mistress or, you know, somebody on the side. So we don't do that simply because it hurts. No, lying. If you'd lie to somebody, oh, that just like a dagger to the heart. Why did you do that to me? You didn't have to lie. Look, you know, if you've done something wrong, just tell me. I'll give you amnesty. Please, I gave this talk before, and I gave this a strong talk in Thailand. The reason there's corruption in this world, the reason why people lie is they're afraid of telling the truth. The reason why they're afraid of telling the truth is because there's too many harsh consequences for telling the truth. Harsh quantity, you get scolded. you get hit, you get sort of punished for telling the truth. So when that happens, we don't want to tell the truth. Please, in your relationship with your partner, please tell them, you can tell me the truth, anything, as long as it's the truth, you have amnesty. Whatever it is. Okay, no scolding. Of course I'll be hurt, I can't stop that, but I'm not going to get angry at you because the truth is the biggest. That's part of being kind. Kind people will encourage the truth by forgiveness, amnesty. Wouldn't it be a wonderful world? Just for you, imagine. Imagine you can come up to somebody and you can say exactly what's true, all the terrible, stupid things you've been doing and thinking, and knowing you'll be accepted. Knowing you won't be scolded. You'll be understood, respected. By respect, I mean, you know, you're not perfect, but you're respected for being who you are, imperfect, making mistakes, telling stupid things, doing stupid things every now and again, but you're trying. The 70% rule. So, see if you can give each other amnesty. As long as you're telling the truth, I'll respect you and I will forgive you. What a beautiful world that would be. What that would mean is because we give each other freedom, we live up to that freedom, we become better human beings as a result, we don't make too many mistakes, we don't tell so many lies, we don't want to hurt those people. Our self-esteem increases, we feel good about ourselves, we feel peace. There's something incredibly powerful about these teachings. Even the idea of, like, you know, the meditation you do. Hopefully you get the idea, the meditation you do before with the talk and the talk, hopefully they should go together. There's no difference between them. The way you meditate is the way you live your life. The way you live your life is the way you meditate. It's all a matter of letting go, not controlling, not trying to sort of be a dictator to your body and mind. Many of you who have gone on my retreats have heard me say many times, you get up in the morning and what you do, you ask your mind, hi mind, how are you going? What do you want to do today? You don't control your mind. You don't tell your mind, now, sit down, watch the breath, and don't you move or else. No thoughts, okay, or you're in big trouble. That is not the way you meditate. It's the way some people meditate. It's the wrong way. You never get anywhere, you get more tense. How you meditate? Hi, mind, how are you doing? What do you want to do today? You work with your mind as a friend. You work with your breath and your body as a friend, not as a control freak. Your body, your mind is not your slave. I've said that many times. It's a friend. Now, if you look at your body and mind like that, you don't try and control it. You give it compassion. All those psychological blocks which stop a person being free and being happy and being healthy as well, are removed. You feel so free. You allow yourself to be who you are, not trying to make yourself anything different, not trying to convert yourself to being some enlightened being. Love yourself for who you are. Stop trying to convert yourself. That's why His Holiness the Dalai Lama keeps going around saying, I've come here to teach, not to convert anybody. And there's something very powerful there. Although I must admit, anyone who goes to our retreat centre in Jhana Grove, you'll see at the entrance is a notice there, a signboard. It's, you know, it's a bit of a joke, but it was actually very effective because, first of all, we tried to keep people from wandering into that retreat centre. It's a place of quiet. So we could actually put trespassers will be prosecuted, but that never works because people aren't afraid. So instead we put something which is much more scary. It's on our notice board there that trespassers will be converted. It's amazing how many people that keeps out. We never do that. Because the whole idea of converting somebody is like trying to control them, trying to make them different. It's actually hating a person instead of loving them for who they are. So please, don't try and convert the person you live with into being some ideal being. Love them for who they are. Don't try and convert yourself into being some sort of ideal being, somebody you want to aspire towards. If you do that, you try to control yourself. You go backwards in the spiritual path. Don't convert yourself. Just be happy with who you are. Open the door of your heart to yourself. Little me. Apparently, a few people have been telling me this. I'm not sure if it's true. Now, Aung San Suu Kyi, she received the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, delayed for about, I don't know how many years. And in her Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, she mentioned Open the Door of Your Heart, my book. It's interesting, isn't it? Who knows? Maybe it's only opened the door of her gate at the front of her house. She's not under house arrest anymore. But even if she did read my book, you know, you have to admit that, you know, if you're under house arrest for over 20 years, you'd read anything. Nothing else to read. So I can't take too much pride in this. But certainly, I mean, this is what we mean about open the door of your heart to yourself. Whoever I am, whatever I've ever done in life, with all my faults, idiosyncrasies, bad jokes, bad breath, whatever else you do which is bad, you think's bad, no. I'm going to open the door to myself totally. Whoever I am, I'm at peace with myself. The door of my heart is open to me, all of me. Not just the stuff I like, not just the stuff which I'm proud of, but even the stuff, the silly, stupid stuff. The door of my heart's open to me. That's the complete opposite of conversion. It's acceptance. It's compassion. And I know whenever I say that, I've said it so many times, everybody goes quiet because you know that is profound. That is really deep stuff. And if you can ever do that to yourself, you know how powerful that is. You feel so free. You mean I can let all that stuff in? I don't have to be afraid of it. I don't need to get rid of part of me. No, bring it in. Let it be. Embrace yourself totally as you are. Warts and all, as they say. Get this wonderful sense of peace and ease and freedom. And you understand the reason why I've given this talk of non-control. And then at last, all those things you ever wanted to be, you are. Peace at last, happiness, freedom. When you try and make it happen, never does. When you let go, there it is. No control. I'm going to finish off with one of Ajahn Chah's profound stories, which I usually only give at retreats, but now I think it's a good time to share it here. I was telling this in Thailand, and many people, they read books by Ajahn Chah, but this is not in any of those books. A great teacher was telling me how to meditate and get enlightened, how to be at peace with myself, how to be free. And this is the essence of the talk which I've just been giving about no authority. One of the reasons why Buddhism is growing in our modern world. He said when I first went to his monastery about 38 years ago now, he said his monastery, this forest in the middle of the northeast of Thailand, he said his forest was a mango orchard. He said those mango trees were planted by the Buddha himself. And he said those mango trees are now mature and there's thousands of ripe, juicy, sweet mangoes hanging off the branches and twigs of all those trees. He said, you monks, nuns, men and women these days, you don't need to climb the tree to get a mango. You don't need to shake the tree. You don't even need to throw a stick up at the tree to get a mango. All you need to do to get a mango is just to hold out your hand, open your palm, and a mango will fall into it. When I heard that, I thought, that's absolutely stupid and crazy. I've known mango trees. If I sat under a mango tree with my hand open, way before, probably be hours before a mango fell anyway, and if it did fall, knowing my luck, it would fall on my head. Never in my head. But that was Ajahn Chah's simile. You know what he meant now? Stop shaking the mango tree. Stop trying to control your partner. Stop trying to climb the tree of life. Sit underneath it. Open the door of your heart And the beautiful peace, happiness, freedom, whatever you want in life, will just fall into it. That is how it happens. Counterintuitive, but you give it a try, and it works. That's why the Buddha said, after me, just the teachings, that's all we need. We don't need a control freak anymore. I don't need to have anyone shake your tree. Just sit underneath it. Open the door of your heart. And all these wonderful things will fall in. That's the talk for this evening. Okay, so now we have some questions. So yeah, it was on the internet. Sometimes they get it together and it's live streamed, sometimes it ain't. You know, I was told about 30,000 people listen to every talk throughout the world tonight. So it's amazing how many people. So we've got one from New York, one from Mexico, and one from Melbourne. I suppose Melbourne's the other side of the globe somewhere. So John from New York. Dear Ajahn, as you said, we are the product of the various conditions without any fixed core. If controlling is choosing the right conditioning, is there anything wrong with that? Exactly, John. You're choosing the right conditionings, and the right condition is choosing not to choose anything. Let it go, let be. So that is the best way in life. But at the very least, you can see in New York, for goodness sake, just how chaotic that is. And isn't it wonderful just letting things be? Try getting up in the morning in New York and just having no plans. Amazing what happens, because you're opening up, you know, to the unexpected. You're opening up to life, because when you have all these plans, you try and control your life. Often you're looking into the forward, what will happen next, because this is what I'm going to make it happen, instead of actually being here in the present moment. So a lot of times controlling is losing the present moment. So that's one of the best things. The right conditionings are what happens when you let go. My friend has a 13-year-old who wants to play computer 24/7 and avoid school. She has MS and has no energy to count him. What can she do? Please advise. The 13-year-old who wants to play computer games. Maybe I shouldn't mention this, but there was one of the friends over, a friend of one of the monks. He wanted to play computer games, and his mother and father always told him not to. But then eventually, I think he didn't actually go to university, but he started a computer game store, franchised all over Australia, a multimillionaire now, so now he can play computer games all day, and he's in his 30s or 40s, I think. That's interesting, isn't it? I get into a lot of trouble from parents when I say that, because their child said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. So he wants to play computer games and avoid school. He's in Melbourne. Obviously, sometimes why do you want to play computer games? Avoiding the real world. Maybe the real world is not so flash for that poor kid. It's a bigger question for me, basically. But there's all sorts of... Now, she's got MS, which is very difficult. There's no energy to counter him. If you really think that's going to cause him a lot of problems, which it probably will, then obviously you need help from other B people. See what you can get from the school, from counsellors, from social services. Maybe to get some peers to try and get him to come off the computer. 24/7 is, now I'm sure it can't be exactly 24/7. We always have to sleep and eat, so there's some time where we have to get off that computer. Maybe there may be some other skillful means to get him off the computer. I'm not sure. Maybe you can put subliminal messages on the computer, every flashing up every few seconds. Computer sucks. Computer sucks. Whatever it is, I don't know. I'm just thinking on the spot. So I know a lot of kids get into those computer games now. Maybe you can put some sort of program on the computer which you can buy, so you know you can only sort of watch computers there for 4 or 5 hours or something. Some sort of little screen, I'm not sure. Anyway, basically, I'm not sure. Fatima from Mexico. How do we deal with an alcoholic controlling person? Hopefully that's not you. But if it is the person you're living with, that's a very difficult one to do. Sometimes you ask, well, now, why people do now get really into alcohol? alcohol is a poison, is, I think, the London School of Economics did research, and they said it's the worst drug in the whole world. Its social effects are much worse than heroin, results of heroin. The London School of Economics did this survey and said basically it's the drug number one in terms of social problems it produces. So it'd be wonderful if there can be some program like with cigarettes, you know, not to criminalize alcohol, because otherwise you just give the same problems that criminalizing drugs does, but to learn to see it as a medical problem, a psychology problem, drinking alcohol, escaping from a world, which is what a lot of people do, they drink to forget. Why is the world so bad that they have to sort of get into this stupor of alcohol? You can have much more fun without it. So I think the person, they're alcoholic controlling because maybe they're from fear, maybe they're having a depressing life. Sometimes there are ways of overcoming that. Maybe to tell them to come listen to talks from this place or other places to see if they can find another alternative to alcohol, another alternative to controlling. If they can come into this moment, be at peace with themselves, open the door of the heart to themselves, maybe they won't do that anymore. But another way is, there was a lady who came here many years ago. I mentioned this story in Opening the Door of Your Heart. Amazing lady. She came up to me once and said, I want to thank you for saving our life. All the talks you've given over the last 7 years have changed my life and my husband's life all around. And her story was that her husband was very abusive to her. Now, domestic abuse is about 25 years ago. And in those days, many women would just take it and they wouldn't go to the social services to get help. I don't know if there was that help around at the time anyway. So she told us she came to this center over here, not because she was a Buddhist, it was just a place where she could escape to for a couple of hours, where she knew she wouldn't be hit. Really, she only told me about this now at the very end, but she said what she heard here was this wonderful positive forgiveness. Not just forgiveness, because that's not enough. So the positive part of it was whenever her partner behaved appropriately, kindly, softly, then she would just go up to him, give him hugs and kisses. And whenever he was abusive, and she was I don't advise this at all, she was an amazing lady, she would just take it. And she said it took her 7 years to turn that man totally around. She never gave any feedback to the abuse. She only gave feedback to the kindness. And little by little, by not giving feedback to abuse, it just diminished. By giving feedback, positive feedback to the kindness, it grew. Exactly the same as that fellow I said at the beginning, you treat the other part of the patient, not the schizophrenia. So see if you can treat the other part of that person, not the alcoholic part, not the controlling part, but the other part. Treat that. Recognize that. If you can do this, and not many people can, that part will grow. And that person you're living with will recognize there's another part to them than the alcoholic part. There's another part to them than the controlling part, and that part will grow, and maybe they'll be free. But that really takes a lot out of the person who asked that question. I'm not sure if you can do it. So if you have to live with them, then that's the only option. But if you can escape, maybe escape. Okay, so tough questions. I'm not sure if I answered them to a great degree, but sometimes hope I answer 70% right. If I make 30% mistakes, that's perfect. So thank you all for listening. So now, are there any questions from the floor? Because people in Perth sometimes complain they've got to live overseas to get a question answered. Any questions from here? Yes, Norm at the back.
Is that the same, bullying the same as you would respond to?
Oh, they're all bullying, abusive? Yeah. No, I think one of the things with bullying, again, one of the other things which I often say to people is, if you're a kid in a class, the number of bullies in a class or in a school are very small. The other kids are much greater in number. They can only join together and stand up to the bully together. Then the bully would sort of, you know, be basically they'd be bullied by the numbers, and they wouldn't be able to get away with it. But sometimes a bully picks on people, and the other kids let it happen. So stand together, and when you stand together, you know, the bullies can't sort of defeat you. And it's just a short-term solution. The long-term solution: why does a kid think they have to be a bully to get some respect in school? Why do they have to be the tough guy to feel good about themselves? Now, is it sort of, you know, our society just, especially with boys, maybe girls these days, celebrates the tough guys? The tough guys at football, the tough guys in the movies. Maybe we're giving the wrong message to our kids. You know, being a kind guy is much better than being a bully. I don't know, I'm just throwing out some suggestions. You know, where do those bullies come from? Why do kids want to be a bully? So maybe there's some deeper problem there. And that is, say, a role model which they learn from somewhere or other. Okay, so it's getting late now. So it's time to finish off. So we're just going to pay respects to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha with the three bows and the arahang, and then we can go and do whatever we need to do.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami